Back here on Back on the Field with Rob Drummond, former Syracuse NFL and CFL player, here with us every single week on WakeUpCallDT.com. Also wearing a hat now. You're a proud owner of one of your Wake Up Call Dance Tour hats, so appreciate you wearing that, Rob.
All right, thank you. No problem.
So how have you been doing? I know you said not a big fan of the coldness, even though you played up here in Syracuse.
You learn a little bit after years and years and years of being able to deal with it and play when you go outside. So, you know, it's just adjusting, and I adjust pretty well.
So, looking at the Syracuse team, outside of the cold weather, not a cold team, heated up when they needed to, they seem to always get that one game a year that most people think they shouldn't get. Last couple of years it's come across. West Virginia was last year, Louisville this year. When Louisville came in undefeated, what was your initial thought based on how Syracuse was at the time and whether or not Syracuse could win that game?
You know, my initial thought was which Syracuse team is going to show up. You know, I've been saying all year long, they're a Jekyll and Hyde team. They play in spurts and show, you know, games where they have brilliance, you know, and great play, but then they show games where they just completely falter and just forget what it is to play the game of football. I had said before, many a times on the show, that establishing a ground game, you know, can set identity and set the tone for the game, and that's what they did. They basically went out there and took the game to Louisville, and you do that by the run. You don't do that by passing, you know, because passing, you really don't establish identity. It's considered more finesse. Whereas pounding the ball constantly and constantly at the team, it wears them down, it wears their will down. And that's what Syracuse did. And my hat's off goes off to the offensive coordinator who basically called run after run after run, and then a pass, and then a run after run. You know, and it basically wears the defense will down. And then that's what really got Syracuse's victory, I feel. That, the defense played well, and the special teams stepped up when they had to.
Looking at establishing the run and what Syracuse was able to do, not only being successful, but on third down, on third and two for Jerome Smith and for Prince Tyson Gully, they both score their touchdowns, breaking out on runs on third and two. And just go on, you know, we talk about establishing the run, but giving it to the running back on third down, let's just go into that and how important it is there, because obviously it was successful, but Syracuse not trying to force the pass on third down.
I mean, what people don't understand is that the game's played at levels. You know, on first down, you want to be able to get it to a short down. So you want a second and third to 4 to 5, or a third down and 3 to 4 to 5 yards. And that completely changed the dynamics and the makeup of the game and the plays you called. Syracuse were in second and short, or third and shorts the entire game. And that makes for a great, I mean, it gives an offense confidence, it gives a running back confidence. The offensive line know they just have to drive their guys a little bit that much, you know, that much farther. So what I said before, it establishes an identity for any team, not just Syracuse, but any team out there in the country, and they realize that. And now the defenses are on their heels. Now the offense on the other field, or on the other team, are arguing back and forth with the defense, you know, get them out of the game, you know, or get a stop so we can get back on the field. So it definitely creates an identity for the team that's really running the ball well. And I'm glad Syracuse were in situations where it was third and short or second and short, and they can get the first down, because first downs are what keeps the chains moving, and that's what you want to do, because that eventually leads to touchdowns, which is what they got.
Seeing the fact that Syracuse has such a good quarterback in Ryan Nassib, his ability to take over the field when he needs to, but being on a team now where he has essentially three different running backs in Jerome Smith, Prince Tyson Gully, and Adonis Amin Moore that have been successful, how much does it open up a guy like him for these last two games?
I think it gives Nassib a great deal of confidence in himself and also with the three running backs he's had. You know, now he basically has to relax and just go out there and play Syracuse football. This last game he showed and he proved what he can do on a national stage against a nationally highly ranked team if they just go out there and play the Syracuse brand of football. You know, they got the ground game running early and it opened up so many other things. The defense has been playing well all year, but also the defense and offense, they feed off one another. And then when those two components of the game come together, the special teams component of the game came together, and it was just a great day for Syracuse to watch them go out there and actually execute and play like they're capable of playing, you know. The last two games are home, but if they keep the momentum, if they keep doing what it is, they learn that through exiting and in the classroom while they're practicing and preparing for Missouri, they'll be just fine.
Going on the road, as you just mentioned, Syracuse has had a lot of trouble in winning those games and hasn't been able to come away. You see a team that goes to Minnesota, loses that game, goes to Rutgers, loses that game. Earlier on in the quote-unquote home game that was still away when they played against USC at Jets/Giant Stadium, they lose that game too. They hadn't won a game in almost 2 years in the Big East on the road until they went down to South Florida and won in the last 3 seconds and then lost to a team like Cincinnati. So the road is against them. What is it about the road, and from your playing days too, What is it about the road that changes? Is it primarily just the fan base, or what is it in general?
It really has nothing to do with the fan base, because, you know, whether fans show up or they don't, you always play a game and prepare for a game as if there was going to be 50,000 or one person there. You know, and it sounds bad, but you're not playing for the fans. You're playing for the love of the game, and that's what the game of football should be played. If you're playing just for fans alone, you're not going to go out there and give 110%. But if you're playing for the love of the game, with the passion that you have, the reason that you put on that uniform and that helmet, then you're truly playing a game of football. You know, that's one thing I always say. Syracuse just had to get out of the media. You know, stop listening to the press clippings, stop listening to the papers, stop listening to the radio, you know, stop believing the hype, stop, you know, whatever they say, it doesn't matter. I mean, when you step onto that practice field, you prepare yourself, you know, as you would in life, to be the best player, to be the best person, to be the best athlete you possibly can be. And that's how you should approach every practice. The games are the same way. It doesn't matter if it's home or if it doesn't matter if it's away. It matters from a little bit from a standpoint where if you're home, the crowd will chill a little bit louder. But you know what? It's. I always say when I was a player personally, when my back was against the wall, it's when you got the best out of me. So these young men have to, these next two games, you know, just go out there and just play relaxing. Just play the brand of football that basically coaches teach them how to play. Syracuse University, we're a blue-collar town, hard-nosed, go out there and give 110% effort every time we step onto the field. That's all they have to do. But the one thing I will ask them to do is establish the run game and establish it early. You know, create an identity out in Missouri that says that, you know what, we're Syracuse University football. We're going to smash you in the mouth. So what are you going to do? You know, let them counterpunch. And then once they counterpunch, then you react again. It's a chess match, football is. And then once these coaches and these players realize that, they'll be fine.
So you think that the most important thing for Syracuse to do to kind of get out of this road funk is first and foremost to establish that run in order to make that first chess move, so to speak?
You know what? You punch somebody in the nose first, and now what are they? Now they're in the defensive. They have no idea what you're going to do. Now they're off guard, and now you can sit there and execute and do everything you want to do while they're off guard. That's what Syracuse has to do.
Looking at the road, when we talk about, like you said, fan base to you never really mattered, what do you think it is to this team? Because they've talked so much about the 12th man, about how important the Carrier Dome is, about how loud it was against Louisville, against Louisville this past week, and knowing the fact that Louisville burned two timeouts in the first quarter of the game because of the loudness, you would like to think that played a part, that they needed to use it so early. I think they used their first one within the first few minutes of the game in that quarter. So when you see the Loud House in that respect, and the team's talking so much about how important it is to have that Loud House, do you think they're relying too much on that, and that might be why they get affected on the road?
I mean, as I said before, I mean, I'm not like in their huddle, I'm not in their practice. Yeah. Everybody can't say, you know, from a base of a fan base, it's like, you know, the fans do matter from the standpoint that, you know, they cheer for you, you know, and that makes you feel good inside as an athlete when they're cheering for you, you know. But there are a lot of fair weather fans, and I'm not 20 years of pro and collegiate experience. I've understood that, you know, so you can't.
You really play in Philadelphia.
Yeah. So you really can't depend on fans always cheering for you. So you have to somehow, some way, find the motivation within yourself to be able to go out there and still lift yourself up and be able to play at a higher level, you know, because you can't always rely on the fans, because there are some fair weather fans out there, and you hear the good, you know, as well as the bad also, you know, so you can't take it to heart. But just go out there and just do your best, and seriously, just not worry about, you know, the fans, because the fans can always be there for you. You know, you have to find within yourself what it is that takes you, that motivates you to want to go out there and give your best effort to get and have the best ability to be able to go out there and surround yourself with teammates who are willing to feed in to the same way you feel, that feeling you have just going out and just playing damn good football. And that's all they have to do. Stop worrying about the fans. Look at one another, because when you're in practice, when you're in meetings, it's like the fans aren't there. Just the players and the coaches are there. So that's what you have to have trust in. That's what you have to believe in. That's who you have to go out there and fight for day in and day out, just to be able to even get through practice and get through a season, much less take it one game at a time.
You look at this team, and getting back to the run game, Adonis Amin Moore comes back. It's been two weeks off the field because of a knee injury that he had. You see him come back, and in his three games prior to going out, had a touchdown in each game in the red zone. This time around, he gets the ball 7 yards ahead, and then they fake it to him and get a touchdown in the red zone to Llewellyn Coker. Four different trips, four different games, all touchdowns, having to do in some way with Adonis Amin Moore. Mm-hmm. How important is this sophomore running back?
You know what? It's very important. So now it's from a standpoint where they basically put him in games where they know touchdowns possibly would happen, you know, because those are pretty good odds, pretty good ratio for him being in the game to get in that close to get a touchdown. You know, but you could say lucky charm, you could say whatever it is, but when the young man's in the game, he garners respect. You know, and so they know at any given time, you know, he can get the ball. He's a battering ram. He's going to get it in there, or play action fake right off him and get a touchdown. You know, so it's a good thing to have.
Jerome Smith and then Prince Tyson Gulley. We'll start with Jerome Smith. This is the guy who gets that first carry pretty much every single game the ball goes to him. He's been, throughout the entire season, win or lose, has made respectable plays and has never looked bad on the stat sheet, has never looked bad on the field, more importantly. What is Jerome Smith, in your mind, being a back for Syracuse, what does he mean to this team?
You know, he's a very impressive young running back there. You know, he really sets the tone because he's such a not just athletic running back, but he's a power back also. To where now he keeps defenses on their heel. They have no idea what this young man is going to do, but they better, you know, but they better prepare and tighten their chin strap because he can run you over and knock you out if you're not careful. So that's the identity, you know, and that's what I'm trying to talk about. It's like, you know, run him. I don't care if you get 1 yard. The simple fact that you'll sit there and run three plays, boom, 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 all run plays, all power plays at you, it's just like a prize fighter. It lets the other team know that it's like, you know what, we're here to play football. It will eventually get into the finesse part of the game because it's a long game to play, but we want to establish and show you that we're ready to play power football if we have to and we can. And that keeps a defense, and that keeps a, even an offensive coordinator and defense coordinator on their heel because now they don't understand, they don't know what to expect, you know, because here you see, you know, it might be a sleeping dog, you know, you may think that the team is down, but wait a minute, they have fight in them, and they're really ready early on, able to come out and show you that they have fight in them and they're ready to punch you. So it's definitely, I mean, football is a lot like a prize fight. You know, just waiting to see what the other person is going to do. Then once they show you their hand, then you react. Show them your hand early and then you control the rest of the game. I've always felt my years of playing football, it's basically just like a prize fight.
So you're looking at something like poker where it's never good to show your hand, but in this case, it is good to show your hand first off, is what you're saying.
No, show your hand and you keep the other team on their heel. Because here's the thing, you show your hand, but it's not just one set hand. You have, what, 60 other players out there that you can possibly go to and, you know, and get a draw from them. So, you know, you show them what you're willing to do because a good offense coordinator can always adjust. You know, so all right, now they bring people in the box to stop the run. Now you go over the top. But, you know, they're thinking, wait a minute, they're trying to run the ball down their throat. They've proven they'll run this ball down their throat. You know, and you go over the top. Just like a good passing game. The minute you come out and you throw a ball in the first play, imagine this, the first play, you go deep with every receiver. You try to throw the ball deep. What are the defensive best in, I think, the rest of the game? Wow, wait a minute. They're willing to go deep. So I better be on my heels and, you know, start running as soon as these receivers come under the break. So now these defensive backs, they're not worried about the play call. They're worried about, wait a minute, this receiver will go deep. They show me in the first play. They'll go for a bomb. So now they're staying back. They're staying a good 2 to 3 yards back, you know, in their coverage. So now this makes the running game that much more, you know, that much more susceptible to be able to be successful because now these guys are back deep because they think you run deep. It's a mind game. Football's 90% mental. And people don't realize that. These offensive coordinators understand that. And Syracuse needs to realize that and use that to their advantage.
Going to that mental part before we get to Prince Tyson Gulley, I've said it before that it doesn't matter how much you, I mean, strength and conditioning, it's important. Mm-hmm. Obviously, knowledge of the playbook is important. Your overall preparedness, your endurance, those are all vital. What you eat, what you're drinking before the game, what you're doing. But to me, the most important thing has always been mental because I think the mind is the strongest muscle in respect of you can play yourself out of a game and you can play yourself into a game because you could be the most prepared person in the world, but mentally, if you don't believe you can do it, it doesn't work out. How important is mentality? Is it the same to you?
Oh, it's very correct. I mean, that's one thing. When I played, I used to go through my preparation during the week of just mentally preparing myself for the game. I would go over a game mentally in my head at least 3 or 4 times during the week. You know, it didn't have to be a perfect game. I mean, I would give myself mistakes here and there, but from those mistakes, I'd tell myself, it's like, no, Robert, correct them. You know, if you did this wrong, do this wrong. If you did this wrong, do this wrong. If I was doing something, preparing for a game during the week in preparation leading up to a game, and I would get something wrong in practice, I would go into a game and actually get the exact same thing wrong in the mental preparation during the game. But then, I mean, it would mentally force me to correct it. So by the time the game came around, it was easy for me because I worked so hard in practice, you know, physically and mentally, that when the game came along, you know, it was relaxed time. You know, so the games were easy to me. I mean, I don't mean that to sound condescending or make it sound as if I didn't go out there and give 100%, 10%, because I did. You know, but if you're mentally prepared, you know, physically prepared during the week, games are easy. And that's what these kids need to do. They need to learn how to and get back to what we did back, you know, during the stellar days of Syracuse. And that was mentally prepare ourselves for games and physically prepare ourselves for games. When the games came along, they were fun.
Social media, having Twitter, having Facebook, all this going on, does this affect mental preparedness for players in your mind now because there's this need to connect with people and to constantly be out there in social media?
I think it does, personally. You know, it's just with Facebook and Twitter and the internet and everything, you know, and you got guys writing good articles about you and bad articles about you. It's as I said before, you know, don't believe the hype. Don't believe what the good things are said about you. And don't believe the bad things that are said about you. As long as you are willing to go out there you know, and give 110% effort, like, as I said, in a football meeting room and on the field, in the classroom also, you know, the only person that really can judge you is yourself. You know, you know what you did wrong. I mean, there'd be games where I'd grade out on a film, and I'd grade out 100%. But mentally, I'd know I did something wrong. You know, the coach didn't catch it, but I knew I did something wrong. You know, I missed a key or I missed a block, and I just got lucky on it. They still grade me out at 100%. But I was my toughest critic. I was like, you know, Robert, you didn't grade 100%. You made a mistake. It didn't cost you this time, you know, but you made a mistake. And I would go back and revamp the way I trained, the way I prepared, and get better. That's what these kids just have to do. Just be your worst critic. You know, just go out there and don't worry about what others think about you. Just go out there and just do the best you can, because that's all anyone can ever ask.
Prince Tyson Gully, going back to the running game, we talked about Jerome Smith. Prince told me at the beginning of the season that where his comfort level is his finesse outside. Once he can bounce the outside, get around the pile, that's where he's dangerous and that's where he can't be stopped. You see that he turns the corner and on his first touchdown jumps into the end zone sideways, and then the other time keeps himself from going out of bounds, stumbling a little bit, and then just charging forward. How good is a back like Gully once he gets out in the open field? Because obviously you played the game, you've seen a lot of backs in your history, you played with different guys, and you've looked across the NFL too. When you see Gully in the open field, how good is this guy?
Oh, he's a very, very talented running back. I mean, it's a young man who definitely won on my team, but I mean, in saying that, what he said, he limits himself. You know, because he's just as good, I think, inside as he is outside. He's more elusive outside, but he's very strong. He's a very effective runner also inside. You know, so when you mentally limit yourself, I mean, you think that you're not good at a certain part of your game, you know, it holds you, it restrains you, you know, it changes you, basically. You know, so all Tyson Gully has to do is go out there and say to himself, it's like, you know what, I'm a complete back. I mean, I may not be the biggest, I may not be the strongest, I may not be the fastest, but he is a complete back, and he has to understand that. He's just as good between those tackles as he is outside. And once he understands that and mentally prepares like that, he'll be lights out for Syracuse. He really will.
Big words coming here from Rob Drummond talking about Syracuse Orange, and now we'll take a look at the NFL and where they are shaped right now. You and I have covered the Eagles for a while.
Ha! Not anymore.
So we look at this last game. It's a divisional game. When you see the Cowboys play the Eagles, the mentality of this NFC East division is that games like this late in the season are going to decide, quite frankly, the division and who's going to the playoffs. In this case, you have two haphazard franchises that are butting heads with each other, don't really know what to do, and are beating themselves more than anything. Coming off of that Dallas-Philadelphia game, where's your mind at with your alma mater?
I'm so done with the Philadelphia Eagles right now until they make changes from top to bottom. Honestly, you have a bunch of Pop Warner athletes out there. It's no insult to Pop Warner athletes, because Pop Warner athletes at least give 110% effort. You know, you have a bunch of overpaid guys who think that they're a lot better than what they truly are. They're basically going through the motions, and it seems like they don't care. You know, it's just, you know, Michael Vick, I mean, God bless his soul, you know, it's just that he's getting pounded out there. I can't say as I feel bad for him, because there are probably a lot of dogs that are smiling from up in heaven. You know, but it is what it is. You know, the game of football is a physical game. It's a gladiator's game. Take the hits and deal with it and move on. He just can't seem to move on. It's just as if he wants somebody to pat him on the back and be like, woes me, we're sorry for you. Foley went in there, you never seen him complain. You know, he got hit just as hard, you know, but it's just, they're in disarray from special teams and on the defense, and it's just not fun to watch, especially against the Cowboys team. I've never been so frustrated before watching a game with Dallas and the Eagles before in my life. And to that point, I remember at halftime, I said to myself, it's like, you know what, I'm done watching them. I'm done beating myself up and being frustrated and knowing so much about the game, and then not doing anything from an organizational standpoint, to where if Andy Reid needed time to grieve for the loss of his son or just anything, it's just all imploding and going wrong for the Eagles right now. They're going to have to revamp that team and start over again. And I was saying to someone the other day, it's funny how, a few years ago when Donovan McNabb, you know, was taking them to championship after NFC championship, and everybody was, they were like yelling and hollering for him. But then as soon as Michael Vick came in, they turned their back on Donovan. But they wish they had Donovan now, huh?
Yeah. And it's funny how in Syracuse, all through Donovan's career, his initial start with Philadelphia, he got booed because they wanted Ricky Williams to come out to the team, and obviously Ricky had his own issues. But from that moment on, it seemed like people here in Syracuse, people who have watched Syracuse and know what Donovan did, always knew what Philadelphia was getting, but Philadelphia didn't.
No, they didn't.
And then losing it, knew that all these people that had been on his back would eventually realize that in losing Donovan, you were losing something that you weren't going to realize right off the bat, but you eventually will. You call for Michael Vick, you call for Kevin Cobb. Cobb is gone, Vick isn't no good to the team right now. And yet Donovan McNabb, in his last crying days of a member of the Philadelphia Eagles, he was a successful guy. If Donovan was there, and I know that we have to take a look at this because he wasn't, if Donovan had remained and Michael Vick had to wait a little bit longer, where do you think Philadelphia would have been?
I think it would have been a much better team and a much better situation right now, because Donovan McNabb is a true leader. You know, the talent-wise, I think Michael Vick is a lot more talented than Donovan McNabb, but mentally, Donovan just had the will to be able to go out there and just make and create plays and not complain and know how to talk to the media and know how to fit in the body language and everything. Donovan was a true, I think, politician. He knew how to, you know, get the best out of those guys on the field, you know, with just his charisma, you know, his character, and everything he did. Whereas Michael Vick wants to cry, complain, the bad body language, the bad passes, that, you know, Donovan himself, you know, it's just Donovan wasn't like that. I think they'd be in a much better situation right now if Michael Vick had waited one or two more years to get back on the field and Donovan stayed with him. But it is what it is, and unfortunately they're not.
Andy Reid as the head coach, Michael Vick as the quarterback. When we talk about changes with Philadelphia, which one is more important to say goodbye to move in the right direction?
I think, that's a tough call, but if it was me personally, I'd say it'd have to be Andy Reid. I mean, there's a lot of coaches out there, whether it be Cowher, you know, or some of the other coaches, John Gruden sitting in the wings, you know. I've heard of Sean Payton, you know, who I've heard has been talking to Dallas. There's some very, very good, you know, not just football coaches, but football minds that are waiting to take their wings. Whereas Andy Reid just put Michael Vick in a situation where he wants him to be, you know, a pass guy, and it caused him to stand in the pocket. So now he's standing in the pocket longer, and he's taking a pounding, and he's getting frustrated. So there's frustration going back and forth, you know, between the players, between the coaches, between everyone. Whereas Andy Reid, I think, as I said before, I mean, the loss of his son, and I look at the Dungy era, where Dungy actually ended up winning a Super Bowl, I think, that year when his son committed suicide. But, you know, guys need time to grieve. You know, maybe Andy needs to take a step away from the game, you know, and just get back to his family, just get back to some understanding. But right now, it's just that he has no concept of what he's doing or how to manage the football team he has out there. And it's sad because it's a professional football team. It's a multi-billion dollar team. You know, so you have to really grab reins, and not just football at this point, it's grab reins of his life. You know, and his family's life, because right now it just seems like doesn't have control of it.
Andy Reid, not just with the death of a loved one, but dealing with a lot the last few years with his family.
Mm-hmm.
When that happens to someone, as it happened to you with your father, what did you need in order to find a connection? Did you ever lose a love for football or lose a love for anything that you had to step away? How was it for you, because you dealt with such a big loss in your life?
For me personally, I never lost a love for football, because football was something that I truly, truly enjoyed to do. It was how I relaxed. I mean, for me, it was more so trying to find understanding as to why. You know, I went through a process of trying to, like, ask why me, you know. People watch the television every single day, you know, but it's like a television for them is escaping reality, because it's like, oh my gosh, look at what just happened to those people out there. But it's not them. It's a whole lot different when it affects you. You know, someone can look out there and be like, wow, a house fire, you know, a family of four were killed. You know, and you have no connection to it, because it was a family of four random people, a family of four complete strangers. But when you watch the TV and it's like, you know, all of a sudden it's like, oh my God, you know, a family of four were killed, and you find out it was your mother, your father, your brother, your sister, something that's connected to you, it's an entirely different world. And trying to find understanding in God, which, I mean, I'm not religious at all. I'm very spiritual, but just trying to find a connection in God and asking God why is the toughest thing for someone to cope when something like that happens, you know. But once you get to the understanding and realize, you know, it's not God's will to have, you know, you be hurt from a destiny of family, but it's an understanding that, you know, the devil work, you know, or evil works in mysterious ways also, you know, but that's just the way of the world. That's just the way of life. And it's just that so it happens that we're all chosen to have something happen to us at one point in our life. We actually have to adapt and adjust to those, you know, and it makes you stronger. You'll be fine. Andy Reid, I don't think, is at that point yet. You know, because he's still just from body language, mannerisms, how he's calling certain plays, how he's calling certain timeouts. Just as he doesn't have the sharp focus that he's had in the Donovan McNair era. You know, that sharp focus, that decisive decision making. Even Philadelphia has for years been known as a screen team, correct? They barely run screens this year. You know, you say to yourself, Andy Reid is getting away from what Andy Reid used to do to make himself successful. And I can attribute it to the fact that he's just lost intellectually right now, because he's probably still grieving, or not probably, he is still grieving the loss of his son and trying to find answers as to why and trying to find understanding.
When you have a guy like Michael Vick on your team and everything that he brings with him, everything with the dog fighting ring and killing dogs and all of that, with what Andy Reid's going through, would a leader who was more clean cut off the field like Donovan McNabb allow him something to lean on? Is it almost an issue, not totally, but somewhat, that Vic really isn't a place where Andy Reid can lean a little bit and know that he has some leadership?
I think if the situation would happen if Donovan were here. Donovan, as I said before, was that true consummate professional athlete, you know, whereas he knew how to deflect things from a coach when things were going bad, you know, not only in his play, but his mannerisms, you know, how he carries himself off the field, you know, just in his professionalism. Whereas Michael Vick, to me, mentally seems like more of a kid, whereas he's sulking just because things aren't going his way. It's like, you know what, okay, I did wrong, but you all should forgive me now, you know, and just get over it. Whereas people are like, no, they're not ready to get over it. But you have to adjust and understand that just because people aren't ready to get over it doesn't mean you have to be an ass, you know. Excuse my language, but just go out there and, you know, just be a human being and just be personable, be presentable. Go out there and play the game that you love to play, because little kids are always, or kids in college aren't playing this game for the $100 million contract like you have. They're playing this game because they love to play this game. And they want to see somebody who's their hero play this game because he loves to play the games. And they're not seeing that right now. And that kind of pressure takes a lot of pressure off a head coach who's going through struggles right now, where if you're not a consummate person or professional, you have to see your coach is hurting now, and it's never about you. You know, it's a team of 53 players out there. Think about them and think about the coaching staff also. And it just doesn't seem to me that Michael Vick hasn't grasped that concept on how to deflect some of the things away from a coach and from a team and put them on his big shoulders, you know, and take out some of that pressure off, because right now he seems to be the one with the passive and the monsters crying about everything that's going wrong in his life.
Not being able to put some on his shoulders, deflecting everything to a team that's also green, but deflecting things toward one player. Coming out recently that Tim Tebow is terrible, that he is the problem, that this is the reason why the Jets aren't where they are. I made the statement that if Tim Tebow is the sole problem of the New York Jets, then global warming is solely because of Fruity Pebbles being created. That's where my head's at. Where's your head at?
I mean, it's like, here's the thing. What has Tim Tebow done to cause the New York Jets to be a bad team? Nothing. They signed him. They gave him $5 million. You know, they put him as backup here, backup there on the punt team, playing on. Then, I mean, Tim Tebow doesn't play on defense. He plays sparingly on offense. He may play sparingly on special teams. How's Tim Tebow the fault of the New York Jets being a bad team?
Right.
That's what I question. You know, I don't know if the Jets were thinking when they brought him in that had him, the Pope, all gods, all his angels and everything else were going to come with the Jets and help them win, but it doesn't work like that. You have to go out there as a team and play the game, you know, and play the game to win. Tebow's just an individual. He goes out there, and I'm pretty sure he gives 110%. I'm not a big Tim Tebow fan, you know, but I like the guy's will. I like his moxie. I like how he goes out there and approaches every practice, every game with a heart, you know, of a warrior, you know, and that's all Tim Tebow is. I mean, he's a man just like anybody else. I have no idea what they expected from him. I said all along that he wasn't the best quarterback out there in the Birmingham team to change your team around, but this is not Tim Tebow's fault, and it's shame on the Jets. And the shame on the Jets players for even making it out to be something this big when it's not.
You look at a story like this and what it's doing, and you take a look back, and we kind of rewind, go back in history to the Jets making a play for Tim Tebow initially. When the Jets decided, we want to bring Tim Tebow in, what did that say to you?
My first question was, why? I mean, it's here you have a second-tier quarterback at best. I mean, I'm just talking about, yes, he's a leader, yes, he's a winner, but as far as throwing motion, that's what it's going to take to win football games. And he's leaving being a starter, coming in as a backup. And it tells me the Jets organization from top to bottom, excuse me, the Jets organization at the time, from top to the stops of the player, have no idea what they're doing. Say, are you guys sure what you want? You bring in all these athletes and you don't coach them upright, and you're a mediocre team year after year after year. Maybe it's not the players. Maybe you should start looking at the coaching staff. Maybe you should start looking at the people in the front office, because, you know, the players are in place, but the players are only going to do, you know, like what it is you tell them to do as a coach. It's like a chess game. You can have a chess game sitting there, and it could look like the greatest game in the world, but unless you have the person behind it to move the pieces, it's just a game. You know, it's just a team, unless you get the coaches to implement, you know, the drills and the plays that'll make it work. And right now, they're not doing a good job of it.
Jacksonville had an opportunity when the Jets did to get Tim Tebow. Now, they both had an opportunity in the draft that they didn't take. Then they both were given a few opportunities when Denver was trying to deal away Tim Tebow once they had brought in Peyton Manning. Would it have made more sense to you that Tim Tebow be a Jacksonville Jaguar, go back home, play in front of the Florida crowd, have an opportunity to be a starter, and fill the seats, basically, just put the Jacksonville Jaguars in a better situation in their home, as opposed to coming and making a circus into a three-ring circus in New York?
You know, I think for marketability reasons, and, you know, in regional areas, it would have made a lot more difference with people going to go to Jacksonville, whereas New York, as you know, well know, is a brutal market to play for. You know, the expectations in New York are pop, pop, pop. You know, they want it quick, they want it fast, they want it in a hurry. You know, whereas Tebow, you know, is a hometown boy from Florida, did well with the Florida Gators, won some national championships, won the Heisman. You know, he'll buy himself a little more time, he'll get better, he'll be able to go out there and work in the great weather, whereas here in New York, it's like we have this cold weather, and I'm pretty sure he's not used to it. So I think going to Jacksonville would have been a much better fit for Tebow in his future, whereas coming to New York, I said to myself, it's a bad move for him. I have no idea where he wanted to do. I could speculate, you know, but I have no idea personally because I don't talk to him. I don't know the young man, you know, as to why he came to New York, but as you see right now, with all things, you know, if you don't make the right choice, it backfires. The grass isn't always greener on the other side, and he's finding out a hard lesson about that.
Let's look at two different scenarios. If Tim Tebow was on Jacksonville, then blank.
I think they'd still be a bad team, but I think they'd find ways to get Tim Tebow on the field to be able to create and do more plays that were conducive to him to being successful in college, like he was successful in college. Whereas they've gotten away from that. They've gotten away from all the things they did in Denver last year that allowed him to win 7 or 8 games. The New York Jets have completely gotten away from it. You know, and it just exposes Tim Tebow for the average at best quarterback that he is. And so on Jacksonville right now, I'd say he'd be remarkable because he'd be in a hometown, and he's a hometown boy, so they're going to accept him with open arms. You know, whereas right now, he's catching a lot of flack for being in New York, and it's sad to watch.
If Tim Tebow remains a New York Jet after this season, then blank.
It's going to implode. His career is in jeopardy if he remains a Jet after this season.
When I look at this team, when I look at the New York Jets, and you look at the fact that in the prior 3 seasons, they've been to the AFC Championship game twice. They did it in Mark Sanchez and Rex Ryan's freshman and sophomore seasons. They have really only one struggling year, which is right by 500. And then you have this year where there's the most struggle. I attribute the offense not being able to get going based on the fact that they have this revolving door, and it's not so much you have this drive, he has that drive, but it's gotten to the point where you have first play, then Tebow, then Sanchez, then back and forth, and you never really know what's going to happen. Is the worst problem on the offense the fact that there is this constant carousel and no quarterback is able to get comfortable?
Well, there's no continuity between the players and the quarterback, between the quarterback and the, you know, receivers, and, you know, who do they throw the ball to? I said earlier in the season, it's like, you know what, you take a chance, you know, go out and get a, you know, a Plaxico Burress, go out and get a, you know, Terrell Owens, go, you know, go out and get a Chad Johnson, you know, a dynamic, aging, so you don't have to give him a long contract receiver who's chomping at the bit and really realizes that, you know, this is my last opportunity to play in the NFL, you know, because these teams are knocking on my door, so you can bring a player in there, you know, it's going to make plays for you here and there, you know, and it may not solve the problem, but it'll jumpstart your younger players, you know, and give you some consistency to where you can be able to go out there and make a few plays. But as I said before, the NFL never wants to be proven wrong. So you have these coaches that go out there and be like, I refuse, you know, to go out there and sign this player, blah, blah, blah. We're going to try and make it work. Young man, it's not working. It's not working at all. You're taking an organization that, as you said before, went to AFC championships, you know, and been there, and been on the brink of going to the Super Bowl, that's now is a laughingstock. You know, they're what, 3-16? You know, and all the potential in the world, all the athletes in the world, but they can't just seem to find to get it together. And when you have quarterbacks, you know, I mean, they may not admit it, but there is a quarterback controversy there because you're bringing Tebow in, you know, after a play. You know, Sanchez goes in for 2 plays, Tebow comes in for a play, boom, boom, boom. You can't get any kind of consistency or any kind of rhythm doing that. And it's just showing the players that we don't have confidence in this guy, so we're going to give this guy a chance to see if he makes a big play. So now to bring the other guy back in, boom, it doesn't work. And it's showing.
To me, when you see one go out and one come in and they kind of look at each other as they go past, yeah. I'm just waiting for the day that there is that nudge or that hit because both guys are competitive, mm-hmm. and I think both guys are getting fed up. If Tim Tebow remains a Jet, what does that mean in your mind to Mark Sanchez? Because to me, having the opportunity to be around him and just knowing that this guy was supposed to be the USC, California, not humble, he's going to be conceited, he loves the limelight. But for as long as I've been around Mark Sanchez, I've seen nothing but respect. Mm-hmm. I've seen humility. I've seen someone who faces adversity well, who has a good mentality, who doesn't want to see the team where it is right now. But I also see a man who cannot exist in this atmosphere. If Tebow's there next year, do you think that in Mark's mind it has to be over?
Mark, if they bring Tebow back next year, Mark Sanchez will have to be traded. Enough's enough already. It's like, you know, for all I at least tried to do, try and make his team a championship caliber team, brought him to two AFC championships game. You couldn't get over that hump. You know, get more players in here to get over that hump. You show me the respect by bringing another player who the whole world thinks is, you know, the holiest thing to God, you know, on the planet, you know, and he competes for a position when I'm clearly a better quarterback. That's no respect for me. And if he's on the team next year, I mean, if I were Mark Sanchez, I'd ask to be traded, which I think he will. He will, and he deserves that. He deserves that much respect.
And I agree with you there that Mark Sanchez, to me, in such a young career with everything that he has done in the position that he's in right now, is so undeserving of what has been placed on his shoulders by the Jets. We have plenty to talk about, but we'll save it for next time here back on the field with Rob Drummond from the NFL, CFL, and, of course, in Central New York for the Syracuse Orange. As always, a thank you.
Thank you.